the other child is also not exposed. So that was the reason for appealing.
What if the child is not there?
Your Honor, with regard to our information and our education, as well as the testimony of Dr. Avis, he indicated that with the fingernail testing that was done with Kane, the exposure reached back to a window of 6 months. So Carter was in the home at that time. He was also returning to the home, so the situation at the time and the admissions of the parents and the ongoing erratic behaviors, he was going to be subjected to that. He came into the home that very same day that Kane was removed after Scott Lang, again, who didn't file any briefs, was tested positive for methamphetamine, presumptive positive, and then made admissions to various people. So the risk of harm started essentially with the methamphetamine use that we found out through the mother's delivery of a baby that was positive for meth, and then stemmed through this chain of events where we tested the child, we allowed the dad some time to come in and test. The day that he chose to test, he was positive for the methamphetamine. Carter was coming back into the home through the probation order that day. He was subject to the same risks that Carter, or that Kane was. And so the state's argument is simply, if one, then we believe both should have been included. And
wasn't Carter already having trouble with drug use?
He was, Your Honor. Prior to that placement at the Madison Youth Facility, he had had one methamphetamine positive, which was part of the reason for his detention.
And what do we have in the record about that?
Your Honors, quite frankly, my recollection was some request from Mr. Baldwin, who was Ms. Lang's attorney, to essentially take judicial notice in review of that. I can't find that anywhere, so I don't know if I missed that or if that was at another hearing, because we did have a number of hearings on this matter. But there was testimony regarding Carter's issues as well. I believe that Angela, the mother, did make admissions that Carter had had some drug
Is that in the record?
Yes, that is in the record. Yes, that is. She also testified about the time frame that he was out of the home. So regardless of any errors I may have made in the remembrance that Mr. Baldwin had asked for judicial notice to be taken of Carter's juvenile records, there was testimony, so that did make that into the record.
And assuming there is something in the record, what does that do to your argument?
I don't know that it necessarily, I think it bolsters it. I think that it indicates that Carter is exposed to this culture, and I don't know if he used drugs with friends. He never did say. I don't know if he used at home. I don't know if watching his parents was something that was a learned behavior, or if it was simply teenage rebellion. But the fact that he was having those issues and then didn't have parents to support him, as they were also using, that places him almost at a greater risk for harm. And quite frankly, we didn't test him because of him coming back into the home. And just on the timing, we were already removing Kane that day, and there was no reason really to test Carter at that point. But I don't think that a drug test of the hair follicles, of the nail follicles, necessarily needs to be done when the parents have both made admissions to the meth use.
Is it your position then that those test results could be eliminated from the record and that nevertheless there was sufficient evidence?
It is, Your Honors. Quite frankly, with the admissions made, the erratic behaviors that the judge observed throughout the many hearings that we had, as well as the testimony of a number of officers that was not objected to by the parents. They objected to a number of the testing records, but they didn't object to some of the statements made by the officers regarding positive tests. Those things are in the record without any issues. So I think that even if the court felt that the drug testing were taken out, I think that there was sufficient evidence to adjudicate and to find risk of harm for both children. And also with regard to that testing, too, Dr. Avas is not somebody off the street. He was essentially an expert. We did offer foundation for him, as well as, I believe, a CV with regard to his qualifications. He's been working at this laboratory that does the hair and nail follicle testing, as well as the cord blood testing for a number of years, testifying on behalf of that facility. reviewing all of the results, and he didn't simply pull up the paperwork. He said that he went through everything, and in his words, to make sure it was in order, but essentially to make sure that it was handled properly through the chain of custody throughout the time that it reached the facility to the time that it left. With that review, I don't think that he is simply Adam off the street, as Ms. Crisp indicated to the court, but an expert that was able to establish the appropriate chain of custody. If we take that away, we are taking away the state's ability to protect children, essentially, by putting a high burden on the state to call that many witnesses from an out-of-state laboratory that does this testing. Essentially, we are saying that if you can't prove all of this, then this child must remain in this environment. In a number of cases, I believe it was Corey P., they held that the exclusionary rule didn't apply. Certainly, if we can come into the home and search without a warrant, and that isn't excluded for child protection, certainly the courts have realized that there is an exceptional reason for that, the protection of the children. Maybe we can't prosecute and prove beyond a reasonable doubt that they've committed a crime, but certainly we should be allowed to protect the children.
What is the purpose of an adjudication hearing?
The purpose of the adjudication hearing is simply to look at the rights of the child and to protect the child. At the dispositional phase, that's when we look at the rights of the parent. So essentially, with regard to my argument in regard to Mr. Lang and the father in this matter, because he did not file anything, the argument is that the adjudication of Kane should stand, and likewise, I think that Carter should also be reversed, and he should be considered under the care of the juvenile court. The rights of the parents will then be addressed at the dispositional phase, which has been done, essentially. We haven't had disposition, but we've had, as Ms. Crisp indicated, a number of status hearings where we've tried to work things through to get the Kane, because Carter was returned home, to get Kane back into the home and not delay things for him.
Do we view this case under the general rubric of a civil case?
Yes, I believe so.
The judge seemed to suggest that Carter was under the supervision of probation, and essentially that was enough.
With all due respect to probation, unfortunately the services aren't the same. With regard to probation, they've essentially allowed him to remain in the home, and that's not done well for our juvenile. He's gotten a number of law violations and has actually been now convicted in the adult court. With regard to probation, it takes a lot more, I believe, to demonstrate enough to move him from the home and to place him out of home. Unfortunately, I don't feel that the Health and Human Services 3A services are the same as the probation services. I'll reserve some time for rebuttal, Your Honor. Thank you.
Thank you. Ms. Crisp, good morning again. You may approach.
Good morning again, Chief Justice and Your Honors. I'd like to start with just explaining to the court, as I'm sure you're aware, that the brief on cross-appeal that the mother, the appellant, made in this matter essentially makes the issues the same. The one issue that is new in Carter's case, however, is I asserted in error that the court shouldn't consider any improper pleadings outside of the record that happened below. That includes a precipice for supplemental transcripts, including juvenile filings from Carter's separate cases that were never judicially noticed nor incorporated into the record, and an affidavit from Amy Osterholt regarding the cost of Dr. Abbas's services at the laboratory. It's improper underneath Nebraska Court Rule of Appellate Procedures 2104A for the court to consider those. In regards to Scott, the parent in this matter and his failure to file a briefing, I don't believe that that affects this court's ability to reverse on plain error for the due process violation that happened to him as well. The record shows that his trial counsel noticed appeal, perfected appeal, sent up to transcript and the bill of exception. So essentially the record is the same in both. So if there's a due process violation in Kane's case, there's also a due process violation in Carter's. And because it's plain error, this court is apt to review that error on its own without filing of a briefing from the father's attorney. Now, whether or not the court erred in dismissing the petition for Carter, we agree with the court that pursuant to In Re Interest of Justine, there was no evidentiary nexus showing that Carter was at any future risk of definite harm. He was outside of the home for some 40 days prior to removal on February 16th, followed by the ex parte order on the 17th. There was no drug test done by the state. They admitted that there was no need, so there was no harm. He was only back for a few number of hours. The record wasn't entirely clear, but it was less than a period of a day that Carter was home with his parents before removed.
Is there evidence in the record that he was involved in some case in the juvenile court involving methamphetamine and drugs?
If the court were to exclude what I just finished arguing, there is evidence in the Bill of Exceptions on page 287, lines 3 through 13, that Carter did test positive for meth. But I will draw Your Honor's attention to that testing for positive for meth occurred on March 21st. That was during a time that Carter was placed in the care and custody of HHS, not his parents. The involvement of probation in this case further does diminish the risk of future harm. The mother testified towards the end of the Bill of Exceptions that she communicated with a number of probation officers. I believe it was three different probation officers Carter had between April of 2016 and the trial, and that through those communications, sharing the intimate family details of having baby boy in January of 2017, probation, knowing the family history, knowing Carter, knowing both of the parents, still decided that it was okay for Carter to return home, and the juvenile court signed off on that to happen on the 16th. And then it was HHS that then removed Carter only a few hours later. This case is not akin to In Re Interest of Chloe P. I believe that's the case that the state referenced, because that was an infant child where the parents were not even feeding a proper amount of formula. These parents, as you will see by the record, there were a number of investigators and HHS representatives that spoke with them over a period of time and inspected their home. And the home was safe. It was adequately stocked with food. Both Kane and Carter were properly clothed. They even visited the school, and there were no concerns for Kane, which goes to show that the family dynamic would be safe for Carter.
What is the purpose of an adjudication hearing?
It is to protect the best interests of the children, but it's also to have the state meet its burden that at a minimum that without intervention there's a definite risk of harm. And for that to be proven, there still must be an evidentiary nexus between the parent's conduct and the definite risk of harm in the best interest weights for the children. Without that nexus, there's no need for removal. And I believe that a parent's constitutional right is separate with each and every child that they have. And the state has a separate burden as to Carter than it did from Kane to show that Carter was at a definite risk of harm. And because there was no test as to Carter, there's no proof that he's at a definite risk of harm or that will likely occur in the future.
Well, if there had been a test of Carter, it would have tested positive, most likely because of his own methamphetamine use. Is that correct?
That's correct.
So it really wouldn't have been any benefit to have a toenail sample or something of that nature done.
There could have been, Your Honor, just the interest of, hypothetically speaking here, there could have been a urine test to narrow that time of the window time. Toenail testing, as Ms. Amy testified, Dr. Bossa, is 6 months. So I think that the state could have narrowed that time frame and showed that in this short exposure that he was with his parents that he was at a definite risk of harm.
How do you counter the argument that you've got both parents admitting to using methamphetamine and you've got a young man who has, I'll call them charges, pending in juvenile court for use of methamphetamine? This is an adjudication, correct?
Correct. Unfortunately, there were admissions, isolated admissions by the parents at different time frames. This court, if you want a case that just shows how this court has handled a similar circumstance in the past, it's In Re Justine. The parents in that case were involved in domestic violence and drug use, and even though the parents together were engaged in that type of activity, they chose to have their children placed with grandparents. So in this case, even though we have a mother and a father that admit to using methamphetamines at different times, and it's clear that the mother was not caring for Kane or Carter during the time that she admitted to using methamphetamine use. She was almost at full-term labor at that time and was outside of the home and not caring for her son. She testified that she has never exposed her children to, nor has she ever place them at risk of harm when she did use substances. Now, the father's, when he admitted, it was later in February, but the time frame that's important there is that investigators were already involved, HHS was already involved, and they had determined that the father was proper to care for Kane during that time. It wasn't until some more than a week later, after Kane's testing for exposure to methamphetamine, that they wanted to test Scott, or the father. So there are two different time frames, and there's no established link to Carter that he was in harm. Now, whether or not the evidentiary nexus is proven, that is crucial to the state's case. It's an evidentiary burden that they must overcome. To say that the parents had not contested their rights to Carter is completely untrue. They've contested from the beginning maintained that although they engaged in illegal substance use, that they never exposed Carter to that.
Is it possible that there could be a denial of due process in one of these two cases but not the other?
I don't believe so, Justice Miller-Lerman, and that's because the transcript and the proceedings were the same. In that short time frame established by In Re Interest of RG, there's no dispute that no hearing was actually held. Ms. Stam, I believe, brought up a point whether or not the parents had ever waived, and they had not. The written denial by both the father's and the mother's counsel in the record is a simple one-sentence denial that denies the allegations in the petition only. I believe this is a right akin to a speedy trial issue in a criminal case, and that it is, you retain that right unless it's explicitly waived, and it was never waived. Therefore, a due process violation happened in both cases. Now, to address the toenail and cordblood testing, I understand that the state is at a burden and has to prove these tests. I'm not asking that every UPS driver, FedEx delivery person be hauled into court. What I'm asking, though, is that the severity that these tests carry in these juvenile cases be held to a heightened standard, that the cost doesn't govern the admissibilities, the rules do. And the rules require a basic amount of foundation to be proven, and Dr. Abbas could not do that. He had absolutely no idea who the technicians were who was involved in the cord blood or the toenail test. He had no idea who the analysts were. He didn't inspect the test. He didn't receive it. He didn't test it the first time, the second time. He didn't write the report. I would like to distinguish the state's cases, Houghton and State v. Williams, that they point out in their cases, but actually, in a way, they're helpful to us. In Houghton, this court, back in 1965, allowed Dr. Green, in that case, to testify because he supervised and directed his technicians, and he knew who those individuals were. And then after that, he wrote the report.
Is your suggestion then that the doctor is just not competent to speak to this?
Correct. It goes to the basic levels of the
admissibility. With respect to admissibility.
Yes.
Thank you.
I'm not saying that another individual at their lab wouldn't be able to satisfy the foundation requirements. It just simply wasn't Dr. Abbas.
Was that the nature of the objection that was raised at the time of the hearing?
Yes. And the state alleges in its brief, if I may continue to answer your question, that this got in through other witnesses. I believe trial counsel objected at all the proper notions. I have a string of sites that are also cited in my brief that it was a continued objection noted by the court. And when the evidence came in through other witnesses, meaning the positive drug testing, the state even admitted that not for the truth of the matter, Your Honor, she was simply using that as for the investigators and HHS's next steps. So with that, I thank you for your time this morning, and I'd ask you to affirm Carter's case. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Is there time for rebuttal? 45, and you may proceed, Ms. Amy.
Thank you. With regard to Ms. Crystal's last statement, it's untrue that all of the evidence and admissions came in as not hearsay or under hearsay exceptions. Judge Rademacher noted in his journal entry adjudicating the minor child, Kane, that other witnesses had testified without objection, and so that's what directed me to go look through the transcript, and I was able to find a number of places where counsel didn't object. So there are places where the admissions were in evidence appropriately. With regard to Ms. Crisp's notion that we should have subjected Carter to some sort of urine test on the day that he was released from Madison and went home for a few hours before Scott L. tested positive for meth over at the HHS office. That's somewhat ludicrous since he had been in Madison for several weeks, months leading up to that. So the 2 or 3 hours home, I don't believe that a urine test would have demonstrated anything, and that would have been simply a waste of time. With regard to the argument that Kane was at some different risk of harm than Carter, that just seems absurd. Both children are going to be living in that same environment. I think that risk of harm is definitely there. The information that we were investigating, the parents, was not something that was shared with the one branch of the juvenile court. We have two justices or judges that hear juvenile cases. That information was not shared with Judge Jorgensen on the day that Carter was returned, and the information provided at that court hearing with Carter was that the mother was not going to be residing in the home. So, anything else, Your Honor? No? All right. Thank you. I appreciate it.
Thank you very much. We will go on to the next case of the day, which is Dragon versus Cheesecake Factory.